Say an amen to that song. Indeed, when nothing else could help, love lifted me. And as we think about the topic this morning, we'll see that that is so. I'm a very privileged and blessed man to be before you this morning as a servant of Christ, as a preacher of God's Word. I'm so blessed, you know, to have, you know, be with the work here as long as I have, and the unity and the harmony that we've had for the truth and all of that. I've just been, I feel so blessed, and to be able to share on the Lord's Day a portion of my reflections in Scripture and the Word of God with you, I consider that a great privilege and honor. And it's just hard to put it into words. You know, I had 3 days this week where I didn't want to think a thought, didn't want to read a thing or even turn the TV on because you just feel so miserable. But when the mind clears and the body pain goes away, you long to be able to be back in the Word and to think about what you might share. And this is what I've decided to share this morning in regards to the trial of Jesus, the illegal trial of Jesus. In the past, I've done an entire series on the trial of Jesus, called it the Old Story. And it had more of a devotional tone to cause us to think deeply about the process that took place in the last hours of Christ. I also preached on the King on the cross, the very 4 hours that He hung on the cross between heaven and earth, and the miracles that took place while Jesus was there on the cross that displayed His kingship. I've never done a lesson that really analyzed the legality of the trial itself. And when I did study that this week, I decided to subtitle the lesson, "The Day That Jerusalem Lost Its Mind." For the very guardians of justice became the biggest criminals. Those whom you should have trusted to be upholders of the law were extremely lawless. And they all knew it. They all knew it. And so, in essence, they lost their minds. In John, the 11th chapter, let's begin there this morning. We'll notice a few weeks leading up to the trial of Jesus that the desire was conceived that this needed to take place, that the deed had to be done. Lazarus had just been raised from the dead. I mean, indisputable miracle. Here's this guy who had been dead 4 days. Everybody knew about it. Everybody was mourning about it. And here he is, alive and well. It's an impossibility. Jesus had wrought the miracle. And the Bible says in verse 45, that many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in Him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation." And one of them said, "Caiaphas, being the high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all. Nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the whole people, and not that the whole nation should perish.' Now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not only for that nation, not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death." So here this secret meeting takes place. What shall we do? To leave him be is to cause everyone to believe in him. And here's the consequences of that. Number one, we lose our place. Self-serving, you see that? Our standing in the empire. Our positions, our councils. And he says we lose the nation. That's number two. And so you see their mindset. You see their priorities. And so they said, Caiaphas, the high priest, said, are you that dumb-witted? You know nothings. Don't you understand? In order to save our place, us and the nation, you got to kill one man. Now, we've got no crime, but it's expedient that he die instead of everybody else. It's expedient. Expedient for who? He says, for us. Verse 50. That's who. And so what you have here is the desire is conceived. And when it is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when it is full grown, it brings forth death. And that's what's going to take place. They didn't know how they do it, but they were going to do it. They were going to do it. Now, I've told my children before that if there's a will, there's a way. You know, you can pretty much do anything you really want to do if you're willing to make the sacrifice and to put in the time, the effort. Before all the sacrifice, before all the time, before all the effort, there first has to be the desire born. And if you really want to do that, you can accomplish it. Now, usually we say that to be done in regards to honorable goals and ambitions. The bigger the goal, the greater the sacrifice. But you know, it's also true of evil goals as well. If you got a will, then you'll find a way. How do you get a man who's never committed a crime to not just be imprisoned, but to be executed? What system of justice would allow something like that to take place? Surely not the Jewish system, right? Let's talk about the Jewish system for just a moment. The law, the judges, the trials, the Sanhedrin, essentially. Now let's start in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. We've been studying the story of Moses, and in so doing, we are also studying the beginning of the Jewish people as a nation, where they received the law and the testimony as a nation. And there was never a nation that God had revealed Himself to like them. He shared with them true law. And so these people could get to know the mind of God. They could actually know what's right and actually know what's wrong. And in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 7 and 8, it says, "For what great nation is there that God is so near to it as the Lord our God is to us? For whatever reason we may call upon Him. And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day?" And so, God being the author of all things, He knows, or holds, I should say, the key to the knowledge of good and evil, just and unjust, righteousness and unrighteousness, honesty and a lie. And God shared this with them intimately. In verse 5 of Deuteronomy 4, He says, "Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me that you should act accordingly to them in the land which you go to possess." Verse 6, "Therefore be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the people who hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.'" Why? Because God gave him the statutes to be wise, to learn what is true wisdom and true justice. And in Deuteronomy 16, we see these statutes set up. Deuteronomy 16, verse 18. 16:18. "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, with the Lord your God, whom your Lord your God gives you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you." And so God's method of judgment was set out there, that there was to be justice in the courts, and that there ought to be local judges that would judge with fairness, not partiality, never expedient for themselves or the pocketbook. But justice was the only order of the day. Now, since God gave the order for this system of government, this is how it became applied. What you had was local councils became known as Sanhedrin. And they would be at various localities. In Jerusalem, it was called the Great Sanhedrin. And so there it was much like the lower courts and the higher courts. You know, like we have our state courts and then there's the Supreme Court. You can see how our system is based off of Judean Christian principles. The way in which it is set up here is much like the way it was set up there. And the Great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem was made up of 71 men. The men in that group were chosen because of their wisdom that has been displayed in their service in the lower courts. So these are not novices. These are not men that are unacquainted with the law or have never really tried a case. They had great experience of wisdom and law and applying these things to situations. They had many, many years of practice of holding up fairness and justice. Now, the Sanhedrin court had a number of principles and laws that were set up. They always required the trial to be public, and a defense would be supplied for the accused, and that there had to be solid evidence from more than one witness. Again, you see how our justice system is based off of theirs. Those are things that are upheld by our courts as well. Now, in regard to a true witness, notice Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 16. It says, "If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days. And the judges shall make careful inquiry. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you." So you see there, built in the law, God made a system that would get rid of false witnesses very, very fast. Because if you got caught and you're a false witness, then whatever you thought should be done to the accused will be done to you. Whether it's his right arm being cut off, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, or your life being taken. And so that deterred a lot of individuals from rising up to offer false testimony. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 7, notice, "And even if it goes through and passes," in Deuteronomy 17, 7, it says, "The hands of the witness shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people." So if you do this unjustly, not only will your conscience forever kill you because you're a liar, but you also get to be a murderer. You see that? You get to throw the first stone. Now remember how Joseph's brother's conscience for over 20 plus years, it killed them. It was ever fresh. They lied about it, and in their minds, their brother was good as dead. They couldn't forgive themselves. They couldn't let it go. They could never find peace. So God had built into this system a way in which it would weed out unfairness and not just judgment. It would take it out. Now, historians have found documents of Sanhedrin procedure. And here's one example they found that they would read to a witness before they'd give their testimony. And I quote, "It is not conjecture or whatever public rumor has brought to you that we ask of you. Consider that a great responsibility rests upon you. If you cause the condemnation of a person unjustly accused, his blood and the blood of all the posterity of him of whom you will have deprived the earth will fall on you. And God will demand of you an account as he demanded of Cain, an account of the blood of Abel. And so now, speak, they would say. Again, you can see how our system parallels a lot of that, where you place the hand on the Bible and swear before God to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. See, these oaths, so that they'd realize the seriousness of what they're about to do. Now they went on to say, we hold it as fundamental that no one shall prejudice himself. That is, if a man accuses himself before a tribunal, they said we must not believe him unless the fact is attested by two other witnesses. So one couldn't prejudice himself. He couldn't confess to it without the testimony of other witnesses. Then they said the witnesses are to attest to the identity of the party. Listen to this. To depose to the month, day, and hour, and the circumstances of the crime. In other words, the rumor is not allowed to be vague. It can't be generalities. It can't be, I heard. No. There has to be facts that are attached to the statement. The month, the day, the hour, and circumstances, specifics were required. So with that in mind, think about what actually took place on that fateful night in Jerusalem, when Jesus stood before that Sanhedrin and had trial. Let's look at Matthew 26. Matthew chapter 26. Jesus being arrested, had been brought to Annas by this time, and now he is at Caiaphas' house. And in verse 57, it says, those that laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest. Remember Caiaphas? The guy in John 11 who said, you guys are a bunch of know-nothings. We're going to have to remove this guy because it's expedient for us. This is the guy. And the scribes and the elders were all assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard. And he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests, the elders, and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, this fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. And the high priest arose and said to him, do you answer nothing? What is it that these men testify against you? But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus said to him, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you've heard his blasphemy. What do you think? And they answered and said, he is deserving of death. So you back up in the story and you see there's some problems right off the get-go. There's the problem of witnesses. They're false witnesses. And they came forward, but were unwilling to put forth their testimony on record because it just didn't jive and agree. And they know the consequences of that. Well, two come forward, agreeing to a saying that Jesus said. But it was in reference to the temple of his body. Remember that? Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll build it back up, raise it back up. His body housed deity. It housed God. And so in a sense, it was the temple of God. But there were false witnesses, the record still says. False due to the whole procedure. There's no month, day, or hour that is given here. And a crime was needed, not a public rumor. This would not actually count in general Sanhedrin trials, local, and certainly shouldn't count in supreme level. The great Sanhedrin, they needed much more. And they knew that. They knew that. They couldn't press forward with that. And so that's why Caiaphas takes the floor and says, just tell us if you're the Christ. Tell us if you're the Christ. And Jesus said that He is the Christ. It is as you said. And what did they say? We got Him now. We got Him now. What further need do we have of witnesses? We don't even need these false witnesses. You heard Him say it. Blasphemy. No witnesses needed. Though, by their law, they were required, actually. They were required. This is illegal, what is taking place. But remember also, their law stated that the simple confession of an individual against himself, or the declaration, however renowned, would not decide a condemnation. End quote. That's their law. So in other words, a person was not allowed to testify against himself and be held guilty. Now, you could confess, you could make a declaration in regards to your innocence. They would allow that. But they wouldn't allow it in regards to guilt, to condemnation. What you see here is that Sanhedrin had built-in laws that gravitated and leaned towards mercy. To make sure the safer route. But what do you have? You have Caiaphas acting here as a judge, as no judge would act today. I mean, could you see a judge stepping at, with his robe out and saying, this guy has done this, let us, jury, go ahead and vote. No, I mean, it wouldn't take place. It wouldn't take place. And again, in fact, in Sanhedrin law, someone could approach and mention something that wasn't a witness. One of the Sanhedrin council, for example. If it was in favor for the person. But they were not allowed to speak if it was not in favor for him. So all these safeguards were built in that leaned towards mercy. So if you were innocent and you were going to court, you had a pretty good feeling about it all. That everything would work out in your favor. Because these laws are built in to help be merciful to one that is innocent, for sure. And that's why I call it the day that Jerusalem lost their mind. They lost their soul. They lost their conscience. And the system of systems to uphold justice was corrupt and full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness, just as Jesus said it was. So they got him on a technicality, so to speak. We all heard him say it. Blasphemy. We just happened to be convened together illegally. But we all heard him say it. He said it. And blasphemy, we all know, from the Old Testament, it carries the sentence of capital punishment. It's like going to trial today for one thing, and being charged guilty for something entirely different. It just can't be done. And that's exactly what they did to Jesus. And the reality of it all is that Jesus actually told the truth. Jesus was not condemned for saying that He was God apart from truth, but for being exactly who He was. He was God in the flesh, the Son of God. Now, Luke chapter 22, verse 65. It's interesting there. Luke 22, verse 65. Who's the one guilty of blasphemy? Luke 22, 65. It says, and many other things they blasphemously spoke against Him. Not one thing or two. Or three or four. But many other things they blasphemously spoke against Him. They were the blasphemers. All the rest of the people were blasphemers. Not Jesus. The very sentence that would be handed to Jesus to condemn Him to die, they were guilty of it. They were guilty of it. But look at also some of the other illegalities of the trial. Jesus was arrested at night, and that was also illegal. Jewish law forbade an arrest at night unless a man was in the act of committing the crime. If he wasn't in the act of committing a crime, and Jesus wasn't, he was in a garden praying. That's what he was doing. It's not against the law to pray at night. And yet they came at Jesus, the Bible tells us, with lanterns and torches and weapons. John 18:3. That was illegal. But also, Jesus was not examined in public. It was an examination that took place in the middle of the night. It's supposed to be public, but guess what? All the public's asleep. This is to be done so that all can see that it's being done fairly. But that's the point. That's the point. It was designed to be unfair. What they were doing, their deed that they had decided to do, was designed to be unfair. And there was a Jewish law that said no trials could take place at night. No trials at all. And that's exactly what took place. They were supposed to wait till after the morning sacrifice. And you think about it, that makes sense, because then that's when the public's awake and they can gather, and then we can, okay, trial can take place. And here they all assembled, the ones that can make a judgment. And they passed judgment. But also it was in the house of the high priest, which was also illegal. You cannot pass a sentence of condemnation outside the hall of judgment. And here they are at Caiaphas' house and said, he's deserving of death. I mean, could you imagine an officer today taking a criminal straight to the judge's house for a ruling? Let's just get this done with. Here he is, judge. What do you say? Right there in the middle of the night. No one around. No, it was just, that's not right. That's unfair. It's to be done in public before a jury with credible witnesses. Now, in them doing this thing, understand what's taking place. They were doing the very thing they spent their entire lives fighting against. Think about that. The Sanhedrin court was designed to save people from false witnesses. And now they're trying to find them and to produce them. This is the night they lost their minds. And again, these are not inexperienced novice individuals. They came from lesser courts. They tried lesser things. They saw people that were cruelly oppressed, and they judged in their favor and took care of the oppressed and the needy and upheld righteousness. Man, it's all thrown out the window here. Further, Jewish law forbade any kind of capital punishment to be held that day that it was passed the sentence. It just couldn't be done. It couldn't be done. Jesus was prosecuted also by the Sanhedrin. That was unfair. They were the judges. They were the jury, not the prosecutors. As I mentioned, Jewish law forbade any kind of capital punishment to be held the day before. And that's exactly what took place when you think about it. Jesus was not given a defense at all. They wanted to ramrod this through, get it accomplished, so that he could be put to death. And he was only accused by false witnesses. Jesus could not be condemned by the testimony of his own mouth alone, and yet that's what they said. What further need do we have for witnesses? And Jesus could not be condemned to die, and I should say, executed the same day. It just could not happen. Again, part of this system leaning towards mercy. If one was condemned to die, they were required to go home and take a day off from hearings to consider their vote that they had cast against that one condemned to die. And then a day after that, reconvene again and ask, had anyone changed their mind? And again, the law had stated, if one had decided that he was innocent, they could not change their vote to guilty. It leaned towards mercy. But one that had said, I choose guilty, could choose to change their vote to innocent. So all this was set up to protect the innocent. And there was no one more innocent than Jesus. Now, while Jesus was condemned to die, they did not possess the right to execute Jesus. Only the Romans did. And so they had to sell the lie to the Romans. And Pilate could smell the stink on that lie. He could smell it a mile away. And he tried to get out and wiggle out and wash his hands out, and there was no way out of it. There was no way out. The Jews had a will, and if there's a will, there's a what? There's a way. And they found a way. And they gave up their mind, they gave up their souls, they gave up their conscience. And they even say, the blood of him be on all of us and of all of our descendants. And in John, the 18th chapter, John chapter 18, you see Jesus there before Pilate. And before the deed was done, this conversation is recorded. John 18, there verse 29. Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they answered and said to him, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." Look at that. You don't have an accusation. It's just trust us. Trust us. This guy's he's a bad apple. Wait a second. Do you see how illegal this is? This system of justice saying this is what we've determined? Pilate, he knew this was no good. Verse 31, Pilate said to him, "You take him, judge him according to your law." Therefore the Jews said to him, "Wait, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death." That the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Well, Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answered him and said, "Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?" And Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew?" You see, Jesus is saying, in other words, are you asking as a Roman or as a Jew? As a Roman, they understood a king and a Caesar and a ruler over physical land. Jesus was not that. But from a Jewish standpoint, from a spiritual kingdom standpoint, Jesus was. Pilate says, "I'm not asking as a Jew. Am I a Jew?" So Jesus says that he is not in that sense. He was not a criminal of the state at all. No civil crime was committed at all. So Jesus, verse 36, answered, said, "My kingdom's not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight." That is like a Roman king. "So that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now, my kingdom is not from here." So with no civil crime being committed, Jesus just believing he was the king of a spiritual kingdom, hence, Pilate really didn't want to have to put him to death. This is a religious dispute. That's why he had put on the cross, remember? Jesus, King of the Jews. Now, verse 35 through 38, essentially you have Pilate determining that there is no fault. There's no fault in this man. And it's because Jesus had never committed a fault. He was perfect. Now listen, if I didn't know that Jesus was perfect and sinless, this Jewish trial and this Roman trial would be something that convinced me that he was. If Jesus ever did anything wrong, these were the men, the wise and learned and accomplished men, to be able to expose that. And they would have found it. And nothing was ever found. And they would not have needed any of these shenanigans at all. Especially from the brain trust of society where justice ought to prevail. So in the Jewish trial, they violated every single law of justice known to them. And they did so willingly. So the trial of Jesus goes down in history as the most unfair trial this world has ever known. Because it condemned to death the only truly innocent person that ever lived. There was no defense. There was no official indictment, no arraignment, no nothing, because there was no crime.
And that's how mad this is. It had to be done quickly. Remember, Jesus even said, what you do, do is quickly. Because if anyone would just pause and soak in what was taking place, they'd see it was madness. It was unfair. It was unjust. And it just kept getting worse. After being sent to Herod and then back to Pilate, Jesus, with a discarded purple robe and a crown of thorns on his head, dripping blood, the crowd cried, give us Barabbas, a murderer! And crucified Jesus, and all Jerusalem agreed. Crucify him. Crucify him. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Paul, speaking about the revelation of God and God revealing His mind to man and His will for man. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 7 and 8, Paul says, but we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew.